Please join me in extending a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, who is Kip C. from Vista, California.
I'm Kip, and I'm an alcoholic. I guess that guy heard about me. I don't know. Powerless my ass. I love that. Yeah. My sobriety date's May 12th, 1984. But the real miracle is I haven't had a drink all day long today. I didn't hurt nobody today. I didn't hurt myself. I worked most of the week and paid my way here. My neighbors all waved at me with all five fingers. My dog runs up to me instead of away from me, you know. I'm on reasonable good terms with my wife. She likes me. She's with me tonight, you know. I'd like to introduce Sabrina right there. She's... Yeah. Me and the kids call her the woman who must be obeyed. And our good friend Diana, who moved up here a couple years ago. We kicked her out of California. I want to thank y'all for letting me come up here and share my experience, strength, and hope with y'all. I noticed we have some new people here tonight. I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what got you here, but I doubt very much if you're on a winning streak. You know, but I assure you that by standing up and introducing yourself as an alcoholic, you are on one now. You know, I didn't come to AA because I wanted to quit drinking. You know, I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I was afraid of going back to prison. I didn't come here because I was afraid of dying. Only reason I came back here was because I wouldn't die. You know, I just wouldn't die. And I hear some of these guys say, you know, for me to drink is to die. I guarantee if I could have got a guarantee that if I would have taken a drink, I would have died. I would have probably drank in the last 20 years, you know. But I don't think I would. I think I'd just be another wino standing there trying to get another, one more short dog, you know, forever. And that gray loneliness, that terror, I think it would ever go away. You know, my father, he's Irish and Sioux. And he liked to drink. And my mother's Irish and Cherokee, and she likes to fight. And, you know, just a general way what it was like in my house. You know, we'd wait for the old man to get home. It'd be getting late. And after a while, you'd hear that truck coming up the driveway, you know. And you'd hear my mother fly out the front door. You looked out the windows. You'd see all the neighbors turning off their lights and grabbing their lawn chairs. You know, because the show was about to begin. And, Mom would meet him at the driver's door with a butcher knife. He'd bail out the passenger door, and their neighbors would be cheering him on, you know. And that was just Monday night, you know. It wasn't no big deal. It wasn't much different than the other neighbor's house. It was just kind of what was going on where I lived. And I thought that was what happened, you know. That was just absolute, total normal to me. I was never going to be an alcoholic. You know, I never wanted to be like my father or those other guys' fathers. I can remember me and my brother laying in bed at night thinking about the kind of men we wanted to be when we grew up, what kind of fathers we were going to be, what kind of husbands we were going to be. And boy, it wasn't anything like those guys. You know, and I can't blame it on my daddy. I mean, if anything in the world, my dad taught me exactly what alcohol will do to a marriage, what it'll do to kids, what it'll do to a career. I can't blame it on him. He showed you exactly what would happen. I've always blamed it on the San Diego Unified School District, you know. In the early 60s, they had this great idea. It was time to bring the young people in and start warning them about that stuff that we don't talk about in A&A, you know. And they brought us on this hall, and they turned off the lights. They showed us this movie, and then they turned the lights on, and they had these guys get up and start talking about this stuff, you know. And after it was over, I hit my buddy Balto in the ribs. I said, Balto, can you get some of this? And he goes, yeah. He says, my daddy smokes that stuff. And I said, well, hook me up, man. And I met him the next day. I said, did you get it? He goes, yeah, meet me after school. I said, okay. So we hooked up after school. I said, so what do we do? He says, well, we got to go boost some wine. I said, why? He says, I don't know. He says, but my daddy always drinks real cheap wine with this stuff, you know, and I didn't want to make any mistakes. So we went down to this little market, and I boosted a short dog, a sweet red port, and he got a bottle of Muscatel. We went down this little canyon. He fired this cigarette up, and he took a hit off of it and handed it to me, and I took a hit off of it. It tasted horrible. And I started coughing, and I took that bottle, and I took that fancy screw cap off and took a pull on it. And that stuff jumped right out of my belly, man. I swallowed, and it just jumped right out, landed right on my shoes. But I ain't no quitter, you know. And I took another pull on that, you know, and started doing that yo-yo thing. You hit your belly, and then come up here, and you got to pinch your nose. You know, after a while, it gets down there, and you take another pull, and it's a little bit easier. By the time you get down to the end of that, it's just going straight down. It's smooth, man. And I finished my bottle, and I looked down at Balto, and he's squatting down there sucking on this little cigarette, and he says, I went, no. I said, you going to drink that? And he goes, knock yourself out. And I drank his Muscatel. I was 12 years old, and it was a real warm day, kind of like today. And I was in this creek bed, and I leaned back, and there was these big clouds going by, and I leaned back, and I put my head in my hands, and I was just looking at the clouds. And I experienced my very first spiritual awakening. You know, and I don't say that. I'm deadly serious. You know, I lived in a neighborhood, me and my brother Bill, we lived in a neighborhood. It was all first-generation Hispanic. There was nobody there that spoke English. Everybody had real dark skin, real dark brown hair, dark brown eyes. And our cousins lived with us a lot of the times. And our cousins have dark skin and dark brown hair and dark brown eyes. And me and my brother were born with real white skin, blue eyes, and white hair. When we went outside, the Mexicans wanted to kick our ass. We went in the house, the Indians wanted to kick our ass, you know. And I lived in terror for as long as I can remember, you know, just waiting to get hit, you know. And I can remember that day I was laying there, and it dawned on me that I wasn't afraid of anything. It was the very first time in my life that I wasn't, it was such an odd feeling that I wasn't afraid what was going to happen next, you know? And I felt like I fit in for the very first time in my life. And I was at peace, and things were calm, and my skin fit. And I know a lot about the first three steps a long time before I met you folks, you know? I knew that when I was 12 years old, I knew that I was powerless over this world, and I knew my life was unmanageable. I drank this magic elixir, and I came to believe that there was a power greater than all of you people. And I immediately, with no reservation, turned my will and life over to it, and I never looked back. You know, a couple of years later, I got kicked out of school for hitting a teacher for the second time. And I got home, and my mom had found my contraband. And I walked up to the door. I hadn't even told her I got kicked out of school yet. And she's standing there, and she's got this bag, and she goes, what's this? I said, I don't know, Mom. It looks like green vegetable matter to me. She goes, get out of my house. I've been waiting for someone to tell me that, you know. And I just did about face, and I split. I was 14, and I went over to Carlsbad. I'm talking to a friend of mine. He says, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know, man. I ain't never been anywhere. And he opened up the newspaper, and he said, hey, check this out. She says, all these people are going up to this place in San Francisco, and all they do up there is get high and listen to music and make love. I like music, you know? When I was 14 years old, that's about all I thought about was music, you know? I still like it a little bit, but I really liked it then, and you know, I get hitchhiked up to this place called Haight-Ashbury in about 1964, and they were right, you know. All that was going on and more. I found out that I was probably the worst hippie that ever got to San Francisco. I grow hair pretty good, as good as anybody. And but I've been fighting all my life, and these people were all pacifist. And I'm used to, if something looks like it's going to jump off, I hit first. I didn't ask questions, you know, and that kept happening. And I just didn't quite fit in with these people either. I found out what I am actually of heart of hearts is that I'm a capitalist pig, because I saw opportunity. I saw what these people wanted, and all my friends come from Mexico. I called my buddy Balto. We put this little deal together, and the bottom line, 2 years later, I was serving a one-year sentence. I was in prison in Mexico for about a year for trying to smuggle some of this stuff, and I was 16 years old. You know, and I got out of that with a bunch of money and knowing a lot of people, and I got back up here, and I was down there for about a year, and just before I turned 18, I ran into this little girl who kept, or after I turned 18, she kept bailing me out of jail. Every time I turned around, this girl was bailing me out of jail. And last time she did it, she bailed me out 3 times in 1 week one time. And I said, "How come you keep bailing me out of jail?" She goes, "Well, what else would I do?" And so I married her, you know, and she was 15 years old. And I just loved the way she thought. And I was sharing a general way what that marriage was like, you know. That's the way it was when we got married. She'd do anything for me. 12 years later, I called her. I'd gone to the store 3 months before to get some cigarettes. And she said, "Where are you?" And I said, "I'm in Zihuatanejo." She goes, "What do you want?" I said, "Send me some money or I'll come home." She said, "Give me the address, you know." And she's a great gal. But, you know, me and her, we got married. I got arrested again. Went back to jail for about almost another year. I got out, and I was on parole. I knew I'd never make parole in California. And I ended up here in Oregon. I landed in Coos Bay and ended up starting logging out of Coquille, and worked out in Coquille and Myrtle Point and up in the hills up there for the next couple of years. And while we were up there, she got pregnant, and we had to go to the hospital down in North Bend. I went down that little hospital in North Bend, and I sat in this room. And after a while, this lady came in. She got me, and she took me in there, and they put this little boy in my arms. And something happened that I wasn't expecting to happen, man. I held that little baby, and I took one look at him, and I touched him, and my heart exploded in my chest. It's the only way I can explain it. I felt absolutely head over heels in love, total unconditional love, which I'd never even experienced with anything or anyone. And I didn't even know you could feel like that, you know? It just blew my mind. And I'm holding this little boy, and I'm just going, "Wow." And I said, "You know what? You're going to be my pal, man. Me and you are going to do all that stuff that fathers and sons do, and you're never going to be afraid. I'm going to make sure you get all this stuff, and we're going to have a good time." And I meant it. You know, I got off parole here in Oregon. I went right back down to California. And continued doing what I do. And after about 2 years, we had to end up in another hospital, and it was the same deal. I went in this room, and they came and got me, and they brought me in, and they put this little baby girl in my arms, and the same thing happened, man. I fell absolutely head over heels in love. Just fell head over heels in love with this little girl. And I promised her, you know, that she was going to be my princess, and that she would never be afraid of nothing, and I'd never let anything hurt her, and she was going to have all the good stuff. You know, I'd had another child born when I was in prison at one time, and I was living with this girl, and I tried to contact her before, and nobody would write back, and I never did get to find out about that child, and it was kind of a hole in my gut. You know, for the next few years, I tried to be the best father. I'd made a lot of money. I did not work. I did a few little things once or twice a year, but all of my time was spent with my children. And my life completely resolved around my children. My brother lived with me, and it was my wife, and we had a big place. And On September 6, 1976, I was watching my son, and my wife was going to get school clothes with my daughter. School was getting ready to start, and a guy came over, and he brought something to smoke over, and we smoked this stuff, and it was real hot. He split, and I wanted something to drink. I went in her house. There was nothing to drink. It was real hot. The only thing I had was my bike there, and I just got on my bike, and I went up the store to go get some beer. I didn't even think about it. When I came back down the hill, the police were in front of my house, and the cops and the fire department and all the neighbors, and I waded through this crowd of people, and I found out that my son had chased me out of the driveway, and he'd been run over by a truck. And I waded through that crowd of people, and I saw my little boy laying there, and his head was split open, and I could see his brains, and the bones were protruding throughout his body. And a big part of me died that day. You know, I sat in the hospital with him for the next 9 months. And every single day they prayed, told me to pray that he died, to just pray that he dies. There's so much brain damage, there's nothing to help. There's nothing to hope for. And I cried out to this God. I don't know nothing about God. I'd never been to anything to do with church or religion or anything like that. My family didn't do that stuff. But I cried out to this God I'd heard people talk about, and I begged him to give me back my son. He said, I'll do anything. You know, my son survived. The little boy's personality, he was gone forever. I got back a child that never mentally or emotionally got beyond the age of about 4 years old, and he spent most of his life in and out of hospitals. 27 major brain surgeries throughout his life, and he couldn't hear and he couldn't talk, and he had lots of problems. And I didn't know whose fault that was, you know. My brother, right in the middle of all this, he'd come to me and something was weird, man, and he went to the doctor, and they committed him, and he had schizophrenia, and they wouldn't let him out of the hospital. He called me, and he said, get me out of here, you know, and I went against the doctor's wishes, and I got him out of that hospital, and I brought him back home with me. And then I had to leave. I had to go somewhere, and my brother was crying, begging me not to go, and I just gave him some money. I said, you know, just hang tight. I'll be back. It's always been me and you. It always will. We'll fix this, whatever it is. You know, I was supposed to be gone for 3 days, and I was gone for 3 weeks. And when I came back, I went looking for my brother and me and my little girl, and we went and knocked on his door at where he lived. And he lived in a little mobile home right across the creek from my house. And I opened that door, and my brother had taken a gun and blown his head off, and his head rolled out the door when I opened it. And another big piece of me broke that day. You know, I don't tell you this because I want to impress you or I want to shock you or anything else. The only reason I even mention this is I like to drive home one very pertinent thing. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in chapter 5, there's a portion in there that covers me. And it says that those among us who got here with grave emotional mental disorders, you know, and I tell you that's who I am. You know, because that day when I opened that door, there was a loud snap that I could hear. It was like a tree branch breaking, and it was my very psyche. It completely snapped. And I can tell you from my heart to yours that I thank God that I'm an alcoholic. I thank God for what alcohol does to me. Because alcohol takes away all the guilt. It takes away all the pain, all the terror, all the loneliness. It gets away those pictures that are burned into my skull. It allows me to lay down and get a little bit of rest at night. Stops the screaming when I get up in the morning and allows me to function in this world reasonably well one day at a time, as long as I keep enough alcohol in my body and I can get through this world. You know, the first time I came here and I heard y'all read the promises, I thought you were talking about alcohol. I'm not kidding you, because those promises, you read them again, that's exactly what alcohol did for me. Every one of those promises. You know, things started leaving. I started drinking. I wasn't in the business that I was in. You don't get drunk and do stupid things. And after a while, my wife, she was in the same, going through the same stuff I was. But, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm very self-centered. And I don't look at anyone else's pain, only my own. And she was going through her own stuff, man. And I wasn't paying no attention with her, and another man was. And she left with him. And I can't blame her a bit. You know, my son was in a special hospital, and it was just me and my little girl, and she was crying her eyes out, you know. She was 5 years old. We were sitting there on the couch, and she was scared. She goes, what's going on, Daddy? She goes, everybody's dying and leaving, and what's going on? I'm so afraid. And I said, baby, you know, we don't need nobody. We don't need nobody at all. Actually, we hit a bump in the road. I'm going to catch my breath here in a minute, and we're going to get through this. And we don't need nobody. I'm not going to let nothing happen to you. Don't worry. Then I got her to sleep, and I put her in her bed. And about that time, a friend of mine came over, and he brought this stuff I'd never drank before. I doubt if you all have heard of it up here. You look pretty sophisticated to me, you know. San Diego, we call it Mad Dog 2020. And you know, I know those new folks here tonight, if you decide you don't want what we have, and maybe you think you're not an alcoholic, I really recommend Mad Dog 2020. Because if you're an alcoholic, like I'm an alcoholic, it'll run your rusty ass back in these rooms so fast you won't even know what happened. I drank this Mad Dog 2020, and the next thing I know, this lady's tapping me on the shoulder to say, "Excuse me, sir, you have to get off the airplane." And I was in my living room the last time I checked, you know, and I open my eyes, I'm on this big wide-body jet, my little girl's sound asleep next to me, all cuddled up, and I'm the only people on this plane. This lady is looking at me, and she's very perturbed, and I'm looking at her, and I'm going, "What?" And she goes, "You have to get off the plane." And I said, "Where am I?" She goes, "You're in Fort Lauderdale." I said, "Florida?" She goes, "Yeah." I said, "I hate Fort Lauderdale." She goes, I don't know nothing about that, sir. You have to get off the airplane." So I haven't got a clue what's going on. But maybe my daughter does, you know. But you got to be cool, you know. I can't just say, "Hey, where are we?" You know, that's... I said, "Wake up, honey." Hopefully she's going to throw me a bone, you know. And she opened her little eyes and she looked out the window and she goes, "Are we there?" I went, "Yeah." "Oh, goody. Okay, well, let's get off the airplane." And we walked down there. She never said another word. And so I did the next indicated thing. I called a cab. I said, "Take us to a hotel and stop at a liquor store. I need to figure out what's happened here." And I came to in this rubber room, and I'm completely naked, and I'm in four-point restraints. I thought I missed something really cool for just a second, you know? And then I saw the color of the walls. It was that green that I know of so well. I've been in prison in three different countries, and they paint every single jail cell the same color. I don't know that, but they must buy it in bulk. It's this green color. It's supposed to be calming, they say. You know, I wasn't calm. You know, and I found out that I'd kind of gone nuts in this hotel the night before. I'd met a young couple there, and they were drinking Wild Turkey, and I was drinking tequila, and they had some of this local Floridian additive. You could really drink when you did this stuff, and we ran out of hard liquor, and I found out they'd never heard of Mad Dog 2020, and I went and got some, and apparently at about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was butt naked down in the lobby trying to introduce myself to some young lady. You know, California, that's no big deal, but they're a little conservative back there. They called the cops. Cops didn't know what to make of me, so they just took me and put me in county mental health. They gave me some Thorazine, settled me right down, you know, and I come to and I'm talking to this doctor, and I said, "You know, this is a big mistake. I've been through a lot of trauma, and I'm getting out of here. You leave me, let me out of here, I'll get out of your state. I'll be out of your state before the sun sets. I give you my word." And the guy says, "Get out of here. I don't know where my kid is. But maybe I got some matches and something, you know, where I can find her. You can't say nothing because they might call the cops. You don't want that to happen." So I get my clothes and I get outside getting ready to look for my kid. And all of a sudden I look and here she comes walking up the steps with this young couple I'd been partying with the night before. And I grabbed hold of her. I said, "Come on, baby, we're getting out of Florida. I told you this place sucks, you know." And we got out of Florida. And I like to tell you, man, that was it. But, man, that was only the very, very beginning. Because for the next 3 years, that's the way we lived. We had traveled through the South. We lived in 5 different states for the next 2 years. And everywhere we lived, we left at a dead run, usually at midnight with no forwarding address. We lived in missions. We lived in buses. We lived on an old abandoned bus one time. Every once in a while, I'd meet a real sick pre-Al-Anon and go through her life like a tornado. If you're here tonight, I'm sorry, you know, but thanks. There's one. The last place was in Oklahoma City. And I'd met this young Christian man on the bus coming out of Georgia, and he was a real nice kid. And I told him what was going on with me, man. And he said, you know, my daddy's got a little business, and we got a little apartment at our place, and why don't you and your daughter come in, and we'll put you up, and you can come to work for my daddy, and you can go to church with us, and we'll give you a job and help you get your daughter in school and help you get your life together. And this was just the nicest people, the nicest family I ever met, man. And they took us into their home, and he said, but you can't drink. You know, we don't allow any alcohol on our premises. And they lived out in the country, and it was all right, I thought. And I was out there for 2 weeks, and I didn't drink. And I went absolutely stark raving sober. I went to work. My little girl, she was just loving it because there was other kids there for her to play, you know, and they were going to church on Sunday, and everything was good until the second week they gave us our paycheck, and this guy I was working with on this ranch, he said, I'm going to town to cash my check. You want to come with me? Well, I'll buy you a beer. Come in late that night. Got blood on my clothes. It ain't mine. Got my little girl up. I said, come on, baby. We're getting out of here. We got to go. And she grabbed some stuff. And we stole that old man's pickup truck and drove to the bus station. Had enough money, I got a ticket back to California, got me a bottle of wine, got on that bus and passed out. And I come to the next morning, my little girl's rocking back and forth and she's crying. I said, what's the matter, baby? She said, Daddy, I'm so hungry, you haven't fed me. We pulled into that bus station in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I got off that bus to get her something to eat. And I went and got her a little sandwich, and I was so sick I needed a drink, and I got a bottle of wine. And I got up to pay for it. And I only had enough money for one or the other. So I had to put her sandwich back. And I had to get on that bus and walk by her, and I couldn't even look at her. And there was this elderly black lady that was looking at me, and she'd been sitting right across from us, but she'd never said one word, man. And I just sat behind her. I couldn't even look. And that lady grabbed my little girl and said, honey, come over here and sit with me. My daughter made me a big lunch, and I hate to ride alone. Why don't you come over here and have lunch with me? And she took care of my daughter all the way back to California. God bless her. And I got back to California. I do what all heroes did. I went to mom's house, you know. I told you about my mom, you know. My mom's she's one of the greatest women I've ever known, and also one of the meanest. And I watched her stab my daddy. I watched her knock out the next door neighbor with a shovel one time. And she had a certain look in her eye. And when she had that look in her eye and she told you to do something, you best just say, yes, ma'am. Didn't matter what it was. She looked at me and she grabbed my little girl and pulled her in the house. She said, you get off my property. Don't you ever come back here. And I said, yes, ma'am. And I left. And she took my daughter and saved her life. The next 3 years, I don't know too much about it. Cliff Roach knows about it. He saw me. You know, a lot of people over in Carlsbad Thursday Night Workshop, they saw me. I lived in a bamboo patch down in Carlsbad, right on in the state. In this little bamboo patch down at the right on the ocean where this restaurant, their septic tank drained into. And it was real dark and it smelled bad in there. Nobody else would go in there, but it looked and smelled just like the inside of my head. And across the Pacific Coast Highway, there was a little 7-Eleven that I could panhandle. And I panhandled for wine until I got a bottle of wine, and I went down to my bush and I drank. And that's the way I lived for the next 3 years. And I don't know too much about it. I don't know too much about it at all. The whole thing's kind of a big blur. But I was standing there one morning, and I was sick, I know. I was always sick, you know. And I needed some wine, and a man pulled up, and he got out of his car, and he was wearing a suit. And he had this square little kid sitting in his car and a square little wife, you know, and he had short hair, wearing wingtips. I couldn't figure out how he could live like that, but he came over and opened his wallet, and he just handed me $2, and he said, God bless you, son, and he walked in the house, walked in the store. And I just beat feet, and I got me a quart of wine, and I had enough money for a short dog. I got outside, and I drank that short dog straight down. And I was shaking real bad, and I opened my eyes, and I was leaning against that glass. And that guy was back in his car, and he was talking to his wife, and his kids were over the seat, and they were looking at me, and they were all talking. And I knew they were talking about me and judging me, and I turned around and flipped them off and cursed them. and went back down to my little bamboo patch. I'm sucking on my bottle of wine, and one of the darndest things that ever happened in my life happened. You know, those, I ain't here to talk about religion. I ain't got no business in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those people were good people, man. They were on the way to the temple to worship the God of their understanding that day. And they weren't judging me. I knew those people were really good today. They were praying for me to the God of their understanding. That's what they were doing. And I'm sucking on this bottle of wine, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, man, I hear this thing inside of my head that says, maybe you ought to go to A&A. That was a weird thing to think about, you know? I had a lot of hallucinations and a lot of audio hallucinations, but none of them had ever suggested that I go to AA. I've been to AA before, see, in nut houses and in detoxes. And in the last 3 years, I've had 100 of these 90-day wonders come down and try to 12-step me and bring me a big book, you know, and I'd get enough money to get a bottle of wine, and they'd be on their way. And I've been to AA, you know, and I try to tell these people that I'm not an alcoholic, you know. I'm a drug addict. I just can't afford any drugs right now. They laughed like that. They said, well, if you ever have a trouble with alcohol and you can't stop drinking and you want to stop drinking, come to AA and we'll love you till you can love yourself. I'm going, right, sure you will. You know, but I remembered that, and I don't really know how. I don't remember any of the events leading up to it, but all of a sudden, that whole period of my life was a series of opening my eyes, and I would be someplace. And then I'd open my eyes, and it's a month later, and I'd be someplace else, you know. But this time I open my eyes, and I'm standing at the back of this room, and all these people are looking at me. They look a lot like you guys. And I'm just standing there, and the guy says, are you looking for Alcoholics Anonymous? And he goes, would you like to introduce yourself? I've been drinking wine all day, every day. And you've probably noticed it by now, but I have a lot of brain damage. It was real apparent then. I'd have these epiphanies of things to say. But what would come out, it would get stuck when I opened my mouth. And it would just go, ah! It was great for panhandling, you know? They asked me to identify myself, and I just stood there, and I went, ah! And the guy smiled, and he said, welcome, have a seat, you know? And I sat down, and I'm waiting for this onslaught of love, you know? And these people, they look like you, man. They're all clean cut, got short hair, just smelling sweet and everything. I thought I was at a PTA meeting or something. And these people are kind of looking at me, and they're going, you know, I've been living in the same clothes for 3 years. You know, my hair comes down past my waist. My beard came down past my belt buckle. I weighed about 120 pounds. I'd covered in wine sores, and a bunch of stuff lived on me besides me. It was kind of a science project, you know. And they're looking at me, and I'm looking at them, and I'm going, man, this was a mistake. I wonder if they have a room for the more severe cases, you know. These do not look like alcoholics to me. And I'm sitting there, you know, and I'm real nervous. And I'm looking at them, and they're looking at me, and pretty soon they're talking. They're talking about God. And I'm going, oh, no. Oh, no. And then they passed a basket, and I knew they were going to start singing. And I said, I got to get out of here, man. I got to get out of this place. And I stood up to leave. And there was this little gal that kept looking at me from the minute I walked in that room, man. She kept smiling at me, trying to catch my eye. I thought she was a real sick one, man. And, you know, I stood up to leave, and there was a guy talking. And this lady stood up, and she cut this guy completely off. And she looked right at me, and she said across the room, she goes, you know, I walked in these rooms 27 years ago in Long Beach, California. I came in that back door just like you did. She got a cop dropped me off, said to go in there. He was tired of arresting me, and I came in this room, and I thought I was at a PTA meeting or something. She goes, I turned around. I wanted to get out of here because I knew when the women turned around and saw me and saw what I was, they'd run me off because they didn't want me around their men. She says, I've been on the streets of Los Angeles since I was 13 years old and done everything a woman ever had to do to live out there. And when I saw you people, I felt dirty and I wanted to leave. But a woman grabbed hold of me and pulled me into the room and said, baby, don't go nowhere. We need you. And got her a cup of coffee. And the woman proceeded to talk about 27 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, about the women who grabbed hold of her and taught her how to be a woman, about a sponsor who took her through the steps and got her actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, about a home group that took care of her and nursed her back to health. And she came back in front of all those people, didn't know what to make of me, man. This old gal threw her arms around me, pulled me down, and kissed me right in the mouth. It was the bravest woman I've ever met in my life, man. And this old gal, man, she's hugging on my neck and squeezing me, man. And she's whispering in my ear. She's going, baby, don't go nowhere. We need you desperately. And she said that thing to me, man. I'll tell you something. People have been beating on me since I landed on your planet. Ain't nobody in this world ever made me cry about nothing. I don't give that up for nobody. And I'm standing there in front of the PTA, and this old gal's hugging on me. And all of a sudden, my eyes started getting wet, and my stomach started rumbling, and I'm standing there, and I'm crying like a baby right in front of you folks. And I started coming to A&A. And y'all lied to me right from the very beginning. Every one of you did. You said, you know, just don't drink and go to meetings. If you are a real alcoholic, and someone tells you that, get away from them. Get away from them. I am an alcoholic of the absolute hopeless variety. And what that means is alcohol is not my problem. Alcohol has never been my problem. It never will be my problem. It has been a problem for you people, my drinking, but it has never been a problem for me. My problem is I have an acute allergic reaction to sobriety. You know, in about 3 days, I can't imagine why anybody in this world would ever want to feel that way. Everything's so real. You know, how do you ever go to sleep at night? How do you stop the people talking in there? And he said, just go to meetings and don't drink. And I did that, man, and I would go start raving sober. And I'd stay sober as long as I possibly could, man, sometimes 2 or 3 days. Never slept, wanted to kill someone or myself, but I finally ended up having to drink before something blew, you know. And I kept coming to AA, and I kept going, I'll just go to meetings and don't drink. And I go, okay. And I just do this. I go to meetings and not drink. And finally, this one guy said, I said, how come, is there anything else? He says, well, some of us get a sponsor. I said, what's a sponsor? And he goes, explained it to me, and I went, no. I've been on parole most of my life. I'm not going to volunteer. And I went by that one. I don't need that, you know. So I kept going. I went for another year, still living in the bushes, you know, and I can't get sober. And another year and a half, still living in the bushes. But I'm going to meetings every day. Every day I'm going to meetings, man. And I stay sober as long as I can. And finally this guy says, I saw this guy that came in, and he got sober. He came in when I did, and he was sober. I said, what are you doing? He goes, well, I'm taking these steps. And he showed me these steps, and I looked at those steps, and they didn't apply to me either. You know? I looked at it, and I said, I'm not powerless. I've been carrying a gun since I was 14 years old. You know? Unmanageable? I like it that way. You know, I love chaos. I hate mediocrity is my greatest fear. You know? Insanity, you know, don't go there. God stuff, don't need that. What's this? He goes, well, you got to write down everything you've ever done and admit it to another human being. Now, I haven't got into it in depth, but I'm a career criminal. And a very good one, I might add, you know. And I spent a lifetime trying not to establish a paper trail of my activities. Now you want me to write it all down and share it with the PTA. Folks, that's not going to happen. I guarantee you that. That is not going to happen. I'll go past that one. I saw this defect. Don't know what they're talking about. Got to what's this? He said, well, you got to find everybody you've ever harmed and make things right. I said, what does that mean? He goes, you got to go find him and face him and make things right. And I'm going, oh, you bet. Hey, Loopy, it's Kip. Hey, brother, hold it. I'm sorry I shot you and your brother and your dog and took all your dope. But I'm in a spiritual manner of living today, and I'm here to make things right, you know? You know, that may be fine for you folks that come from the suburbs, you know, but, man, there are places I can't go back to, all their kinfolk are dead, you know. But you want me to hunt them all down, that's not going to happen. I guarantee you, that is not going to happen. I wouldn't even make it up Loopy's driveway. But I kept coming here, man. I wanted what y'all had so bad. Not all of you. Still don't want what all of you have. But some of you people had something I wanted, and it wasn't your women, it wasn't your stuff, and it wasn't anything else. It was except the look in your eye and the way I watched you walk through your life with a little bit of dignity. That's what I wanted more than anything in this world. You look at you, and they were at peace with themselves, and that's what I wanted more than anything in this world. And you know, I come to May 12th, or January 6th, Christmas morning of 1983, in the rubber room, butt naked, hog-tied. Cops had beat me down real bad that night. It had broken both my cheekbones, and I'd been bleeding on that mat all night. And my face was stuck to the mat from the dried blood. And I'm trying to pull my face off the mat and roll over. It's hard to do when you're all hog-tied back like that, but I did it. And I rolled over, and I saw these cops looking down at me laughing. And I knew Santa Claus wasn't coming that day, you know. And they let me out. It was Christmas. I found out it was the usual thing. I got in an argument with the cops. They beat the hell out of me and locked me up until I sobered up. And they said, Merry Christmas. Get out of here. I went away. I think they made a mistake, though, because they had $90 in my pockets when I let me go. I've never had $90 in years, but I had $90 when they let me go. And I made a conscious decision. I ain't going back to AA. I ain't going back. It don't work for me, man. I went and spent $90 on Gallo Port wine. It was one of the most beautiful sights. It took me two trips to get it to my hooch, you know. And I started drinking that day, man. And I started drinking around the clock. And on January 6th of 1984, the floor fell out. I remember that day crystal clear, man. It was the worst, the most terrifying day of my whole life since I've been on this planet. The vision for you, it talks about it real clearly. It says, there'll come a time where you cannot imagine life with alcohol or without it. It says, you'll know loneliness such as few people can even imagine. You come to the jumping off spot and you wish for the end. You've been coming to AA for a long time and AA don't work for you. It just don't work. The day that alcohol stops working, you're going to know loneliness that few people can even imagine. And you got no place to go. And I pulled out my gun and I put it to my heart and I pulled the trigger. And it blew my left lung and two ribs out and knocked me across the room. I'm sliding down this wall. And the only thing I can think of is, thank God this nightmare is over, but just let me the hell out of here. And I come to in this hospital. You thought I died, didn't you? Yeah. There was this old guy in AA. I hated his guts. His name was Charlie Tuck. He'd been here so long, he said they only had one A when he got here. He was one of those old-timers that always say, I'm a grateful alcoholic. And I just wanted to throw up on his wingtips every time he said that to me, you know. And he came up to me in a meeting one of those times when I was in and out of here, and he got dead in my face one time, and he looked at me real close. He says, you think you're pretty tough, don't you, kid? And I looked him right in the eye, and I said, yeah, I'm tough, old man. Don't you ever doubt that. He got this big grin, and he put his nose right on top of mine. He says, you ain't tough. He says, you're the scaredest son of a bitch in this room. Now, that might make you dangerous, but it don't make you tough. And he walked away laughing at me, you know? I avoided that man like the plague. He knew. I'd go to an AA meeting, I'd look in every single window before I'd go in there to make sure he wasn't in, you know. And I'm dead, right? I'm laying there. I'm waiting for whatever's going to happen next. And I hear this deep, gravelly voice off in the distance. And I open my eyes, and there's Charlie Tuck standing at the foot of my bed with these two brand new newcomers, and their eyes as big as saucers. And he's standing there with that ugly blue book, you know. And I knew I've died. I've gone to hell. This is it. Chained to a gurney for eternity, shoving this A up my butt a nickel at a time, you know. And I'm laying there waiting for it to start, and Charlie just looked at me, and he looked at me with a compassion he had never given me before, but he didn't say one word to me. He put his arm around these two young men, and he said, you see this pitiful human being laying here? And they're looking at me, and I got holes coming out of every hole in my body and a few new ones I've made. And their eyes are real big, and they're going, yeah. And you go, look, real close, and pay close attention. Because this is what happens to an alcoholic who refuses to take the steps. Come on, let's go. Hurt my feelings. I'm proud to tell you that those two men are still sober to this day. They take their cake both at Thursday Night Workshop in Carlsbad every year, and every year they thank me from the podium, you know? And I was doing active 12-step work quite a while before I got sober, you know? I went, you know, I ended up in a hospital. I stayed there for months. I got out, and, nothing worked, nothing worked, nothing worked. I wanted to die so bad. I just wanted to die. I would just, alcohol did nothing, took away the pain. Nothing took away the loneliness. You know, I was the loneliest human being on the face of this earth. And that's one word, man. You know, we all come from different places, different bottoms, different stories. But when we start talking about that alcohol loneliness, we know what it smells like, we know what it tastes like, and we know what it feels like better than any group of human beings on the face of the earth. I believe that with all my heart. Because alcohol had separated me from all of humanity. There was no room for another human being to even get anywhere near me. I lived inside of that bottle. Nothing could get close to me. And I was dying for someone to touch me and at the same time telling me to get back, you know. And I'm laying there. I'm laying on this bed, May 12th, 1984, and I want to drink. And I know if I start drinking, I know I'm not going to die. It's just going to go on. And I cried out. I just said, God help me. I was laying flat on my back. I said, God help me. And it was like I had, I'm one of the real lucky ones. I'm one of the real lucky ones. Because right then and there, something happened that I haven't heard happen to a lot of people. I had a vision that morning. A vision that morning of the day that I was holding my daughter when she was born, and my son. And I remembered how much I loved those children, that I could never imagine loving anything or doing anything in this world that would ever harm them. And I can remember feeling that love and knowing it. And the next picture I had, it was just like a click, and it was that morning on that bus with me walking right past my daughter while she's starving, and I'm traded her food for a bottle of wine. And I knew within my heart of hearts, without a shadow of a doubt, the true meaning of what it means when it says I'm powerless over alcohol. That alcohol is my master, it's my Lord. It tells me where I can go, when I can go. It tells me when I got to go to bed and when I got to get up. It tells me everything about my life, and there's no room for another human being, no matter what's going on, unless you're buying me a drink. And it doesn't matter about my morals or my dreams or my plans. And it sure as hell doesn't matter about yours. You know, I was thinking about, you know, that all the people in AA that had tried to help me, and not just people in AA, but good people all across the world in different walks of life that reached out and tried to help me. And no human power in the face of this sun can stop me from drinking when this thing clicks. When it clicks and it tells me it's time to drink. There's nothing in this world that can stop me unless you put me in a cage. And you better not put no sugar in there with me, you know. And I got to that last part, a thing that I'd been denying since I got here. Man, I wanted nothing to do with this God stuff I heard you people talk about. But I started thinking about the people who had what I wanted. And the one thing all those people had that I wanted, I watched them walk through stuff I couldn't imagine walking through, and they didn't drink. And I watched them walk with dignity through their life. And they had a little sparkle in their eye. And all of them talked about the same thing a lot. They talked about this power. They talked about this power that did for them what they couldn't do for themselves. And I crawled down on my knees that morning and I said, you know, I don't know who you are and I don't know what you are. But from this day forward, I'll do anything that you put in front of me. And if you're not there, I'm screwed, you know. And I knew without a shadow of a doubt that very instant that if I could hold on to that, I wasn't going to have to drink. And I have never, ever known that before. And it wasn't a guess, it was a knowing. I knew without a shadow of a doubt that if I could hold on to this, I wasn't going to have to drink. And I got over to Charlie Tuck's house. You know, where else am I going to go? And I knocked on his door, and Charlie Tuck took me in. And he, St. Edie, his wife, she was a member of Al-Anon 40-some years, you know. And she opened the door, and she goes, "Ah, Kip, oh, God, Charlie's going to be so excited. You're his favorite, you know." I'm going, "Really?" I found out later she told everybody that, you know, but no one ever needed to hear it more than I did. And she took me around back, and Charlie came out, and he walked out, and his eyes got real big. He says, "Good morning, Kip. How are you, son?" I said, "I'm okay, Charlie." He says, "What can I do for you?" I said, "Charlie, I don't want to drink no more." He goes, "Yeah, I've heard you say that for quite a while." He goes, "I got one question." He says, "Are you done?" I said, "Charlie, I don't know nothing about God, but I know you do. And I'm willing to pray to your God that I'm done." And he goes, "Wow, that's pretty good." But he sat down beside me, and he says, "Kip," he says, "I got some good news and some bad news for you." He says, "I've been watching you for a long time." He says, "The bad news is people like you don't get sober, not even an Alcoholics Anonymous. Something inside of you is badly, badly broken, and I don't know what that is. That's between you and God. But it's also, the good news is this, that I've been here for a long time, and I see a certain spark in your eye that I don't see all the time. And I fully believe with all my heart that God has opened a window for you. And I suggest you step through with both feet and don't ever look back. And this is the way it's going to have to be for you one day at a time the rest of your life. That absolutely nothing, no woman, no job, no child, no nothing can ever become more important than you doing the things that you must do to maintain your sobriety. And that's a lot more than just going to meetings." He says, "Are you willing to do that?" And I said, "I'll do whatever you tell me." He says, "Good, follow me." He took me across the street at this little holiday park, and it was on Mother's Day, and it was all these families there. And he got right out in the middle of all these people, and he dropped on his knees. He said, "Come on, get on your knees." I'm looking at all these people, man, and I'm going. He goes, "Don't worry." He says, "These people have been stepping over you for years. You're on your knees. You're halfway to your feet." And he says, "Kip," he says, "the only hope you got is that God is going to bestow some grace on you. Don't ever be ashamed of him or you're a dead man." And I got down on my knees, and that old man taught me how to pray in front of all those people. And he took me back across his room, and he detoxed me on whiskey and orange juice and Karo syrup and AA tapes. And he had a little room set up, man, and he had AA tapes on reel to reel, 6 hours. And for the next 4 days, I was brainwashed by AA tapes, or one of his guys that he sponsored, one after another. I was never alone. They took turns sitting with me and holding my hand and just sitting with me and telling me their story. And then one of them would sit, someone else would come. And after about 4 days, Charlie came in. He turned off the tape player. He said, "Okay, this is a program of action." I said, "So what do we do?" And he said the magic words that I've always thought there should have been a bumper sticker made. So actually, I consider it the first step in recovery. I said, "What do?" He says, "Get in the car." Charlie was blind in his right eye. He had a glass eye. You know, I said, "Where are we going?" He says, "We're going to detox." I said, "I'm detox." He goes, "Not for you. We're going down to 111 Island Street. You're going to carry the message to them folks on the mat." I said, "Okay." And he got in the car, and Charlie got in there. And when Charlie's got a new guy, he never stops talking because he never wants you to get a thought going, you know. And when he's talking to you, he has to look at you. Unfortunately, he's driving. And his right eye is glass, you know. So he puts his front wheels on those little bumpers on the middle of the road, and we start driving by Braille to San Diego. 45 miles later, as we pull into detox, and he's never looked at the road. You know this man has a relationship with God, and you better hang on. And he takes me in this room, and he talks to these drunks for a little bit, and he introduces me, "This guy hasn't had a drink in 4 days. Tell him how you feel." And I talked a little bit, not much. Just said, "You know, I know you guys, and I knew some of these guys, you know. I've been in this place 100 times. And they knew me, and I said, "You know, I haven't had a drink in 4 days. And I haven't wanted one." And they couldn't believe it. You know, and when he walked out, he says, "How do you feel?" I said, "Well, Charlie, that really felt neat." He goes, "That's it. That's the magic. Hold on to your hat, son. Off we went. And that old man launched me in a course of action. I had to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single night for the next 8 years. I come up on 90 days, he goes, I said, well, I got 90 days. He goes, so what? I go, you know, 90 and 90. He goes, none of that applies to you. He taught me the most important word that I ever learned that saved my life. And it will save yours if you're new or if you're not new. And it's the most sacred word in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the word is called commitment. And word commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous means something a lot different here than it means anywhere else. You see, their lives aren't on the line. My life is on the line. If I give you my word I'm going to do something, there's only one excuse for not doing it, and that's I died on the way there. Period. And I don't know about you, but I ran out of excuses the day before I got here, you know? And that's the way my sponsor raised me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was at a meeting every night. I had to get there early. I had to shake hands with every single person that came, help clean up, do whatever I could do in these rooms at all times. Anytime anyone asked for a volunteer, he says, your hand better be first, you know? And that's the way it was, you know? And things started happening. That old man took me through those steps rapidly within the first 90 days. You know, and I'm on, man, and I've been involved in a step study and a book study, and I have been ever since that day. That is the basis of my whole recovery, step studies and book studies. I love that better than any kind of meeting there is. You know, he said, those are the where you'll meet the winners in those rooms. And that's what I started doing, man. And, you know, and things started happening in my life, man. I got a job. He made me get an identification in my real name. It was one of the scariest things I've ever done. You know, I got my hair cut, got shaved, bought some nice clean clothes, started working, started sewing up, started paying my bills on time. That was a learning experience. I got my first check. I said, Charlie, they want all my money. He says, they don't want any of your money. I go, no, they want all my money. He goes, no, they don't want any of your money. They just want theirs. Oh, what a concept. You know, I started kind of growing up in here, you know, and after a while I met her. There's a her or him for all of us in here. Some of us, a few. I met this gal. She liked to fish. She got sober on the same day. It had to be God's will. So, you know, we got married. And we were married for 10 years. Had a great marriage. She was actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. At 3 years sobriety, the state of California gave me my driver's license back, which is a 45-minute story in itself. You know, I got my contractor's license, which is unbelievable. And I came home, I bought a pickup truck and paid cash because my sponsor wouldn't let me buy anything on credit. And I got a phone call, and it was a girl, and it was this girl. She says, is your name Kip? And I said, yeah. She goes, well, do you know so-and-so? And I said, wow, a long time ago. She goes, that's my mother, and you're my father, and I've been looking for you for a long time. And I want you to meet your grandchildren. And that little girl that was born years and years ago, 23 years before that, came into my life and brought me these little grandbabies. And I got to go back and make amends to her mother and her grandmother and that family and all. And they came into my family. And I got custody of my children, of my little girl and my little boy. And then I adopted 4 other kids. And at 10 years of sobriety, man, I had it going on. I just gone traveled to Australia, spent 2 months there. I had a beautiful house up on the hill. I got a boat. I'm sponsoring San Diego, speaking all over the country, you know. I'm secretary of half the meetings in San Diego County and have influence in the rest of them, you know. And I got it going on, man. And I just got back from Australia. I got a business. I'm making a lot of money. And I came home and I opened up the newspaper, and on the front page is the story about a man who broke into a woman's house and raped her in front of her children all night long. And when he was done with her, he took a knife to her and cut her to pieces. And it was my daughter. You know, I got down to the name and I said her name, and I went, no. And I called, and sure enough, it was her, and she was still alive. And I got over to the hospital, and this man had taken, just destroyed this woman. She lost her breast and her face and the use of her left arm. And she did not even look human. And I wanted vengeance, man. This guy was in jail, but that's right where I want him because I can get at him real quick there, you know. And I'm absolutely insane and I'm nuts, and, you know, and I can't tell nobody about this and I'm going crazy. My sponsor told me that the answer was in the book and that nothing could be more important. Absolutely nothing could be more important than me doing whatever I have to do to maintain my sobriety. In the book, it tells me that anger and resentment are the dubious luxury of normal people. But for I'm an alcoholic. And if I harbor these kind of feelings, it'll cut me off from the sunlight of the spirit, and the insanity will return. It doesn't say, unless someone rapes your daughter. It just says straight up. It says in that book, if I got a resentment I can't get rid of, I got to pray for that human being to have everything out of life I want. And the hardest thing I've ever done was to pray for that animal. You know, and he just got out of prison. He lives within 2 miles of me. And my morning prayer is still, not today, God. But if so, I know I'm going to end up his sponsor. I just, you know, it's just the way it always works. I mean, he's got such a sense of humor. Let's see what he can take, you know. Right after that, they told me that I had cancer and I had got to go through this massive surgery on my mouth. And I tell them I can't take any of their dope. And I ended up doing this surgery without any of their dope. And I didn't do it with any kind of dignity whatsoever. I screamed and cried like a little schoolgirl, but I didn't take any of their dope. And all the guys I sponsor, they're all a bunch of outlaw bikers. They came over to take care of me, and I got my mouth, they cut to here like this, and then sewed it all back together. And it was just real tight and sewed together, and it just hurt like hell. And these guys would come over and tell me jokes to try to get me to laugh. They're a lot like you folks, I can tell you. Anyone that would laugh at the humor of that's a very sick person, you know. And I didn't have to use any of their dope, man. The fellowship, the guys hung in and took care of me, man. And that's the way it's always been since I came in here. You know, right after that, my wife, who I love this woman, man. It was the first woman I ever really experienced intimacy with, man. I respected her as a woman, and I treated her like a lady. And I loved her. I really loved her. And something had been going on with her. And I came to her, she said, we got to talk. And I looked at her, I said, about what? She goes, I can't go on this way no more. I can't live this lie no more. She goes, I'm going to drink. I said, what are you talking about? She goes, Kip, she says, I'm a lesbian. And I'm in love with this girl, Chrissy, and I'm leaving. And I'm taking your boat. I said, my boat? I don't know what to say. I had no tools for that whatsoever. I didn't even see it coming, man. And I'm Catholic, and she was Catholic. And I don't know if some of you heard of Father Bill Wilson. He was a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous, an Irish priest in La Jolla, California. And he was my godfather in the church. And I went down and talked to Father Bill, and I'm telling him this sad story, and he's looking at me, and he's going, uh-huh, uh-huh. I said, so what do you think, Father? He goes, what I think is you just came here to try to rat her out to the church. And I'm going, no, Father, I need guidance. He goes, oh, bullshit. He goes, you make me sick. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, oh, you keep telling me, you're always talking about this book and what a wonderful program you work. He goes, you ever bother reading that book? I go, what do you mean? He said, you know, about the power that if I only do everything right and manage well. I go, well, how does that apply? He goes, you keep telling me what a wonderful husband you've been, and you've done this for her, and you've done that for her, and now she's done this. Wait a minute, was there a hook in what you did? And who the hell put you in charge of anyone's sexuality? You know, you have enough trouble with your own. And he goes, she's not your property. She's a good member. She's been a good wife to you, and she thought enough of you to come and tell you. Can you imagine how hard that must have been for her to tell you that? She didn't have to say anything. She could have just walked away. But she thought enough of you to come and tell you. I said, so what do I do? He says, you give her anything she wants. She's been a good wife. And you give her her divorce and give her your blessing. And I said, well, okay. You know, and that's what I did. And neither one of us had to drink. She's still sober. She ended up marrying another lady, and they're happy, I guess. I don't know. Got my boat. They'd have to be happy, you know. You know, the only thing left in my... I got attacked by a dog right after that, and it almost tore my right arm off. I'm in this hospital, and I can't work no more. I lost my house. I lost my business. I lost everything in the world financially that I'd worked for. And they keep wanting to shove dope in my arm. And I got all these bikers, outlaw bikers, about 20 of them in this room. And they're going, don't give this man any narcotics. We want to see that. What are you giving him? What's that? You know, and that's the way it was. These guys just watched over me like a hawk. And they wouldn't let me put any dope in my body. And, you know, I told him, I said, these guys have complete say-so. They'll read anything that you give me, you know. And that's the way I just turned it over to these crazy guys. Most of them could hardly read, you know. But they understand this disease a hell of a lot better than those doctors did, you know. And they took care of me, you know. And the last thing happened, man, the only thing left was just me and my son. And my son got sick. And my little boy, I want to tell you a little thing about the things were promised to me, you know. I traded all my rights as a parent a long time ago. I traded it for wine, for cheap drugs, for anything I could get to turn off any kind of feeling I ever had. That little girl that I drug all around the country. I had a man came up to me at 10 years sobriety, and this man came up and said, I need your permission from you to marry your daughter, Jana. And I have to have your blessing. And I said, do you drink? He said, no, sir. I said, do you work? He says, yes, sir, I'm a pilot for American Airlines. I said, okay. You can marry her, but if you ever lay a hand on her in anger, don't ever sleep in the same place twice, you understand? He goes, yes, sir. And I gave them a wedding that I dreamed about the day she was born, man. I'm still paying for it. That was in 1993. And they're still married, and you know, and she loved me. She loved me, and I gave her away, and she just gave me a little grandson, Alexander the Great, and he worships me, you know. And that little boy, they told me to pray that he died. I got custody of that little boy. And I got involved in the Special Olympics and a lot of men who had handicapped children. And I learned how to be a father to a handicapped child. And I learned to get him in the right schools and get him this. And at the age of 23 years old, that little boy graduated from high school. And my whole home group was there, and he walked down in the black eye, and my whole group was there, and he came down and he gave me his diploma, you know, and I threw that all away. And the only thing left I had at the time was me, just me and my son now. And he got sick, and I had to go take him to a hospital, and I sat him in that hospital for the next 3 months, and he died in my arms on October 3rd, 4th of 1993, and up. You know, it was right then and there that the true promises really came true to me. You know, I got down on my knees that morning, and I thanked the God of my understanding and for all you people that you taught me how to be the kind of father I always dreamed about being. You taught me how to be the kind of man I always wanted to be. You know, I had to have a kind of relationship with my son that I dreamed about the day he was born. And I got to be a good father for 10 years. You know, and I got up and I washed him and I shaved him and I gave him back to God. And I walked on out of there and I didn't know what to do. You know, it was just me. Everything in the world was gone, you know, and I wanted to jam a woman in my life real quick. You know, but my sponsor said, no, he says, you need to work on some things, you know. And I started doing some inventory stuff and I started really doing some inventory on the promises. And it suddenly dawned on me, when it says it will know serenity, I got to figure out that I know what serenity is more than a lot of people. And serenity has nothing to do with a beautiful sunset and walking around with a significant other with a pocket full of money. You know, it has nothing to do with that. It might be nice, but, you know, it's not serenity. Serenity is having a relationship with a God that is so real, so tangible, that you can watch the thing you love most in life die. And hurt more than you knew it was humanly possible to hurt. Didn't even, if you know, if it hurts more than losing a child, if anything hurts more than that, I absolutely believe it would kill you. I believe that with all my heart, it would kill you, it'd drop you dead in your tracks. But at the same time, in the middle of that pain, knowing without a shadow of a doubt that this is God's business and God don't make mistakes, and it ain't personal, it's just life on life's terms. And just, and a knowing, and there's a serenity and a calmness that comes with that. And you don't get that any other way, you know. And I understood that. I said, I'm not afraid of money. I know God's going to take care of me. And God has taken care of me. I wanted to jam a woman in my sponge. I said, but he said, what do you want a woman for? I said, well, I need a relationship. He says, Kip, it's impossible for an alcoholic to have a relationship if they need one. That's not a relationship. He says, you're looking for a human being to make you okay with yourself. Only one that can ever love you the way you need to be loved is God. That's the only person you need. I said, well, can I date? He says, yeah, but keep it real light. He says, I don't want you to get involved in a relationship with a woman until you don't need a woman to validate you as a man. And I said, well, he said, why don't you go to school? So that's what I did. I started going to school, you know, and I had one brief little affair or two or three or something like that. I can't remember. But nothing, you know, it was all real light. It was just a meeting and gone, and I was involved in school. I didn't want to get involved with anybody. And one morning, I just polished all my boots. The car was waxed, you know. I had a big pot of beans going, a sheet of cornbread, and watching a ball game. The dog was up in my lap, and there was this girl that called me from A&A. I'd known her a long time. She said, "Hey, Kip," she goes, "I think you've been alone a long time." I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Why don't you come on over, and I'll cook you dinner, and maybe we can mess around later." Wow, I'm really flattered. I said, "You know, but I got a pot of beans going and some cornbread in the oven, and I'm watching this game. Maybe I could take a rain check. We could do it some other time." She hung up on me, you know. And I went, that's what he was talking about. You know, I said, "You know, I'm sorry, but it didn't matter to me. You know, I'm a full human being without her. I didn't need her, you know." And I went, that's what he was talking about. Cool. And I said, "God, if it be your will, I'd love to experience true love one more time in my life, but if not, that's cool." About 2 weeks later, I get a phone call, and there was this young gal I'd had a little affair with. She had started drinking and ran off, you know, but it was her mother, and she goes, "Oh, I got some horrible news." She goes, "She got drunk last night with her girlfriend. They got in a wreck on Interstate 5, and massive head-on collision. She's got massive brain damage. She's probably never going to get out of the hospital." I went, "Oh, God." I said, "Is there anything I can do to help?" She goes, "Yeah, you can come up here and pick up your daughter." I said, "My daughter? What are you talking about?" She goes, "You don't know." I said, "No, what?" She goes, "You got a 3-month-old daughter." I said, "No." She goes, "Yeah." "She didn't tell you?" I said, "No, no one told me nothing." She goes, "I ain't raising no more kids. You want this kid?" And I said, "Where are you?" She goes, "In Burbank. That's about 100 miles from me." I said, "Well, give me an address." And I wrote down the address, and I had a little got my little sports car, and I drove up to Burbank, and I knocked on this door, and this lady opened the door. She handed me a diaper bag and a bassinet. And this little girl looked at me, and she's got my nose. And she grinned at me, and I'm looking at her, and my heart exploded. I fell absolutely in love. God gave me exactly what I had visions of a blonde with credit cards, you know. I didn't know I was going to have to change her diapers, you know. And, of course, all the guy was said, "Hey, man, you got to get a blood test." I went, no. "That's a double-bladed sword." I said, "You know, God gave me this baby. I ain't giving her back. I don't care if she's mine or not, you know. God gave her to me. And I've never had a blood test. I don't care. She's my daughter, you know. She's going to be 9 years old pretty soon. And she's my sunshine in my life. She's my little buddy." You know what, it was just me and her for about a year, and I got to be a sober father, and my life was full one more time, and I'm bathing her, you know, in the morning and at night and singing to her, and she'd go to meetings with me, and the lady next door watched her while I was at school, and I'd come home, you know, and we'd do our thing, and one night I was at a meeting, and Sabrina was there. Sabrina said, "Can I hold your daughter?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, you can hold my daughter," and I let her hold my daughter, and I saw the way she was looking at her. And after the meeting, I came up to her and I said, "So how's John?" That's the guy that she was married to. And she goes, "Oh, me and John got divorced." And I said, "Oh, God, I'm so sorry. What happened?" She goes, "Well, I wanted to have children and he didn't." I said, "Oh, you like children, do you?" I'd known Sabrina for as long as I've been sober and as long as she's been sober. She came in about 6 months after I did. We went to the same newcomers meeting for years together. And I had a lot of respect for her as a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we started getting to know each other, you know. And we've been married for 8 years now. And she's the love of my life. She's my best friend. She's the woman who must be obeyed, you know. I say that's our joke, you know. But she's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, active with the women she sponsors and her women's groups. We do not go to meetings together. You know, she goes to her meetings, I go to mine. And that's the way we keep it. 7 years ago, we went to a hospital, and I got to deliver and cut the cord on a little boy. And his name is Will. And we called him God's Will until I got to know him. You know, and now his name is Self Will Run Riot. You know, and he's my clone. He thinks like me. He acts like me, you know. And thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I can tell you this, that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is written out in the first 164 pages is absolutely flawless. It will work for absolutely anybody, anywhere, under any circumstance.